Well, we have come to the last week of our series on angels. We've been studying angels since Christmas because the Christmas story is filled with angels, thousands of them. But actually, angels play a key role in the whole story of the Bible. In the scriptures, from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, there are more than 300 references to angels. And what we've learned is that angels are not cute, cuddly little cherubs with wings, but they are fearsome creatures created by God to worship and serve Him. The heavens are filled with these invisible beings. God has an army of angels, too many to count, and the good news is they're on our side. They can bring us messages from God, as we've been saying in this series, visit us in our dreams, comfort, guard, protect, and pray for us. And even though we're not in the Christmas season anymore, there's still something more we can learn from the angels in this final episode of this series. Now, last week we said that angels helped Jesus prepare for his mission to save the world. You might remember Jesus was baptized in the Jordan, and then later on he goes, right after that, he goes out into the desert to be tempted, and it's there where the angels come and strengthen him against that temptation to abandon his mission. And we also said that the angels help us discover our God-given purpose in life and get us ready to go out on our mission. But today we're going to take a closer look at the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. And the gospel writer, John, who wrote this gospel passage today, has a slightly different take on how that public ministry began. For John, it begins with a shocking miracle that has become the topic of many jokes at cocktail parties when Jesus turns water into wine. That's how his public ministry begins, according to John. But the story is not what it seems. It's not about a wedding. At least it's not about a wedding between two people. It's about something much deeper. It's about getting humanity back on track. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. You see, the people of the Bible struggled to obey God's commandments, just like you and I do. God freed them from slavery. He protected them in the desert. He led them into the promised land. He defeated hordes of enemies so that they could settle on that land. He sent them prophets to guide and enlighten them, but they kept failing over and over again. They worshiped other gods. They exploited the poor among them, and they cheated each other. And so the gospel today is really an announcement from heaven that they are going to get back on track, that they don't have to worry anymore because their Savior had come and would fix everything. So I want to take a few minutes and just look at the passage because it's rich with symbolism that explains what's really going on. So the passage begins like this. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, when the wedding took place, you may say, I don't care. What third day is he talking about? What does that mean? It sounds trivial, like a trivial piece of information. But actually, it has huge significance. You see, it focuses our attention back on something that happened 1,500 years before this story. When Moses led the people out of slavery in Egypt, he brought them to a place called Mount Sinai. You've probably heard of that. It's the place where God gave the Ten Commandments to the Israelites. And it was also the place where God offered the people to be in a special relationship with him called a covenant. Well, the people at Mount Sinai all agree to enter into this covenant, and they promised to do everything that God told them to do. Then God tells the Israelites that he will appear to them 3 days later. And he makes a big deal out of it. Moses says, be ready for the third day, for on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people and reveal his glory. And as promised, God appeared and revealed his glory to the Israelites at Mount Sinai on the third day. Now, it's not a coincidence that John uses this same time period, 3 days, to reveal the glory of Jesus to the world, to reveal that Jesus had come to do something amazing. Pointing back to that covenant, he's revealing that Jesus had come to renew that covenant, to renew it. Now, the other thing that happens in this story is that Jesus' mother was also there at this wedding, and there was a bit of a strange interaction between Jesus and Mary, right? Maybe you picked up on it. Mary tells Jesus that the wedding party has run out of wine. She's obviously a caring person because that would have been a huge disaster. She wanted her son to do something about it. She didn't want the couple to be embarrassed. But Jesus seems to disrespect her. Woman, he says, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come. It's an odd exchange, right? I mean, he doesn't even call her by her name. He doesn't say Mary or mommy dearest or whatever you called your mom in ancient Aramaic. He calls her woman, which was an appropriate way to address a woman, a stranger that was a woman back then. You could say, hey, woman, how you doing, woman? But you wouldn't say that to your mother. What Jesus was doing was intentionally distancing himself, not disrespecting her, but distancing himself from an exclusively mother-son relationship in order to show everybody that she was not only Jesus' mother, but also, and this is really important, the embodiment of the people of God. She becomes the representative of all the people who will witness the renewal of this covenant. And just as the people at Mount Sinai, long before, promised to do whatever God told them to do, but didn't, Mary says to the servers, notice the language, do whatever he tells you to do. It's the same language that the people used 1,500 years earlier when that covenant was originally being made. Because John is trying to show everybody that this story is really about what happened back then when God made the original covenant and how Jesus is revealing his glory now to renew that covenant. And then there's one more piece to the story. The main event happens. Jesus turns a huge amount of water, about 180 gallons, into perfect wine. Now, why did he do that? Well, wine was used by the ancient prophets as a symbol to describe God's salvation. For example, the prophet Joel in the Old Testament promises that on that day, on the day of salvation, the mountains will drip with new wine. It was a symbol of God's salvation. And on that day, the covenant God made with his people long before on Mount Sinai would be renewed, and it would be like a great wedding banquet with gobs of great wine. That was the symbolism. And so that's why Jesus turned the water into wine, to show that this new covenant that he had come to establish would be like an unbreakable marriage bond between God and his redeemed people. Just like it says in the first reading when the prophet Isaiah says, as a bridegroom rejoices in his bride, so shall your God rejoice in you. It would be like a marriage. You see, this is far more than a random wedding. This story is an announcement that Jesus has come to renew that original covenant and establish a new marriage bond between God and his faithful people, and those people are represented by Mary. It's a beautiful symbolism of what's happening. And it was a sign that Jesus had come to fulfill that covenant, to save us from our hurts and our hang-ups, our bad choices, our worry and our doubt, our stress and our tension, our sadness and our sorrow. He came to save us from all of that. But many of you are married, probably most of you are or have been married, and you know that marriage takes work. It takes two to tango. Both partners have to give 100%. God always gives more than 100%. But if we're going to live in this marriage covenant, we have to act like redeemed people, right? And that's hard, but that's where the angels can help us. And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the homily, how the angels can help us in this marriage, how they can keep us on track spiritually. See, the angels are kind of like spiritual directors. They try to help you with your relationship with God, and they are uniquely qualified for that role. Let me tell you why. There are 9 types of angels mentioned in the Bible, and they form a hierarchy. And each angelic level is called a choir. And each choir has a different job. The highest choir is made up of angels called the seraphim, which means the burning ones. They had 6 wings, Isaiah saw them. They comprehend God with complete clarity. So their love for him burns the hottest. They're at the top of the pyramid. The next level down of the angels are the cherubim. Their name means fullness of wisdom. And so they contemplate God's wisdom. The thrones come next. Now that's a funny name for a choir of angels, right? Thrones. But they're named that because their job is to contemplate God's throne and the power and the judgments that come out from his throne. Then come the dominions, which means authority, and they command the angels below them. That's the job I would want. And so below them are the virtues who receive their orders from the dominions, and the virtues run the universe and its heavenly bodies, making sure that the trains run on time, so to speak. Then below them are the powers who serve powers, another strange name. They serve the virtues by fighting against evil influences that work against them. And then come the last, I hope you're paying attention because there is going to be a quiz afterwards. The last 3 choirs are the ones who directly intervene in our lives. The principalities, probably never heard of them, they care for cities and governments. Then come the archangels, which carry God's important messages to human beings. Gabriel, Raphael, and Michael are the 3 archangels named in the Bible. And then, on the lowest rung, but very, very important, come the ordinary angels, or guardian angels, that protect and care for every person. Now, if these names sound, some of them sound familiar to you, it's because we hear them in the prayer that the priest recites right before we sing Holy, Holy, Holy. So listen for it today. But the reason I'm telling you all of this is that the angels all have a front row seat to heaven. They are up there contemplating God up close and personal. And they know us very well. And for those 2 reasons, they are very much qualified to help us with our spiritual lives. And if we let them, they can do that in 2 ways. First, angels are master worshipers. They were made to worship God. They live in God's presence always. Even when they come to earth to help people, they're still in heaven somehow. And they stay focused on him all the time. They have front row seats to all the action. But here's the thing. You and I were also made to worship. It's the first and most important purpose that we have in life. To worship God. Like eating or sleeping, you simply cannot live and not worship. The question is not whether you will worship, but what you will worship or who you will worship. You can always tell what someone worships by looking at where they spend their time and their money. And we tend to worship what we believe will give meaning and purpose to our lives. And so sometimes we get a little off track, don't we? Sometimes we worship the wrong things. But worshiping anything less than God will never bring lasting joy. Things like fame and beauty, athletic ability, power, money, all of these things are fleeting. Only God remains a constant, even after we die. And so authentic worship is always directed to God, and it comes with the reward of being deeply fulfilling, even when the circumstances for us aren't so great. And angels can help us worship by gently lifting our minds and hearts to God if we ask them, because they're experts at it. So, you know, if you're sitting in Mass and you're getting distracted, you ask the angels. If you're listening to a homily and you're like, what is this guy blabbing about? Ask the angels. If you're at prayer at home and you're just having trouble focusing, ask the angels. They will help. Whenever we get off track in life, it usually starts with false worship, doesn't it? I mean, it was the same for the Israelites in the Bible, but it's good then that the second way the angels can help us in our spiritual lives is to help us through the struggle of living a good life, right? Every day, you and I struggle to do the right thing, to give more than we take, to build up rather than tear down, to love unconditionally like God, to serve unselfishly like Jesus, to honor the Lord with our whole being. It's a struggle if we're honest about it. A friend of mine recently said that every decision in life ultimately is one between love and money. And it's a powerful battle for control. All of us have times in our lives when we've seen people we know or love do things that seem bad, that seem evil even. And even the best of us have had unspeakable thoughts. It's almost as if we have an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other, whispering in our ears what to do. Now that may seem like a childish image, and it is, but there are bad angels out there. And no study of the angels would be complete without talking about the bad angels. They were good at one point. They were created by God, but of their own free will, they fell into sin. And now they try to tempt people away from doing good. If bad angels, or what we call demons, are real, and they are, then spiritual warfare between good and evil is also real. And guess what? To the victor belongs the spoils, which is your soul and mine. God never tempts us to sin, but demons sometimes do. They tempt us with greed and lust and power and every other deadly sin. They try to convince us that truth is negotiable and that being a little bad sometimes is actually good for you. It's a lie. But the good news is that in this daily struggle to live your best life, God's army is infinitely stronger. The angels are great warriors. They have a lot of experience with it. Long ago, they took out the trash in heaven. They cleaned up the streets of gold and expelled the demons. And whenever you feel weak and tempted, when you're not sure you're doing the right thing, when you so want to have that drink and you know you shouldn't, or walk out on your family, or cheat at work or school, or just give up trying to do the right thing, call on the angels. They will be at your side in an instant. They will come to strengthen you in battle so that one day, when the angel of death comes to carry you home, you will have nothing to fear. Well, we've come to the end of our series on angels. Next week, we pick up a whole new topic. And so many of you have told me how much you've loved this series and you hate to leave it, so I've got one last brief thought for you. It's one of my favorite movies ever. It's made in 1994, and it's a Disney movie. You know I love Disney movies. It's called Angels in the Outfield. It's about a young boy named Roger. It's probably why I love it so much. Anyway, he's living in a foster home. His mom has died, and his dad gave him up because he didn't think he could take care of him. So Roger's living in a foster home, and he prays and prays for a chance to have a real family again. And one day, his dad does come to visit him, and he asks him, "Dad, when can we get back together as a real family?" And his dad says, "When the California Angels, the baseball team, wins the pennant." The team had been down on their luck for a while, so it was a long shot. But Roger didn't get that. He prayed and prayed, and the next game that he snuck into, he sees a group of angels helping the players to win. And the California Angels start to win games, and they make a big, surprising second-half surge to the top of their division. In the final game of the season, none of the Angels show up. But the team wins anyway because they finally believe in themselves. And at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, sorry, Roger is adopted by the team manager played by Danny Glover. All ends well, except the Angels have to fly away. And Roger doesn't like that. He's upset about it. But then one of the Angels comes back to comfort him. And he reminds Roger, "We're always watching." And so even though we have to leave the angels now, remember, they will never really leave you.